value of the field. And then you would get this self-consistent equation. And then you would put in temperature, and then you would find, like in the Weiss theory, that that magnetization proportional to delta was proportional to the expectation value of V would go away in the temperature. So that much you can believe. Much harder to rationalize is that there is a term proportional to the gradient, to the gradient of delta squared. And that I have to explain to you in detail, because I don't see how I can reason that without getting messed up and really some of the important physical elements of the theory. Now, historically, in 1937, Landau said that there was an order parameter, and he was working in analogy to order parameters in general. And so he must have had in mind something like the spin theory, because in spin theory, I showed you that the correlation function went like 1 over 2 squared plus k squared, and hence there would be a term in the effect of action, which was like the gradient of the magnetization squared. And that I'm quite sure is how Landau worked. But I don't believe it. I think it was just a lucky guess. I think that that the understanding of the gradient of the gap squared in the Ginzburg-Landau equation is something quite subtle. So let me begin from the beginning. To show you, give you some vague indication of where you begin from. This gives you an idea of how much I did on the Landau-Ginzburg scheme. I spent days and days and days on understanding what was going on. I think that one can believe. I think one can believe this. I work in the second quantized field, and psi of R is the second quantized field in configuration and spin space. So I think that we can believe this. From the concepts which have been outlined . If this is a second quantized Fermi field, this equation of motion is found by the commutator of the Hamiltonian with it, and the Hartree-Fock approximation, I'm going to put all the stuff that's not characteristic of the BCS theory lumped into this effective Hamiltonian H0, this contained Fourier transform and the CKNK, and so that will give a term H0 psi. in the usual way. So for an unflowing system, this term will have eigenfunctions e to the ik dot r, and it will be the standard. If I would just to stop there, I would build up a whole family C out of the single product functions that are obtained. And I'm always going to work in the scheme where the zero of energy is at the Fermi top, with Ck is epsilon k minus epsilon f. Then in addition, there are, in addition to the Hartree-Fock contractions, there are the non-trivial BCS contractions, which turn an AK into an AK dagger, namely, I would gather a C number, say if I look in Fourier space, there would be an AK dagger, and then I would have a BK dagger average and a BK, and then I would have a commutation relation. And so the AK dagger would be coupled to an AK, an AK prime. In fact, when you do that in detail in Fourier space, you derive the Bugge-Yubov transformation, which I had written, which I reasoned by hand, but that's how you derive it. But I didn't do it, I didn't have time, but I must do the analog. In configuration space. Now, so what that comes from is I write this Hamiltonian in configuration space. I have a V of R, R prime, and then I have psi of R, psi of R dagger, psi of R, psi of R prime. I have our prime dagger. I write all of that in configuration space. Assume that there's an expectation value of psi r up and psi r down. Note that in order for psi to have a non-vanishing expectation value of the same r, that their spins must be opposite. Because by anti-commutation relations, psi r up is equal to zero. And therefore, automatically, in this scheme, you get the pairing of opposite spins, which had to be legislated as an exterior consideration in the Cooper-Pair scheme. We have to say that they were fermions. And if they were in S state, that the fermions in an S state have to have opposite spins. I forgot to mention that. Here it's in. You don't have to do anything. The pairing is of a necessity of opposite spins coming from the term psi r, and then there's a psi r dagger, psi r prime dagger, psi r prime dagger, and that's what will give this. This term, and the delta comes from the psi-psi average. So the delta contains the psi-psi average. So this together with this complex conjugate are the spatial versions of the Bugge-Yubov equations. And you can combine things into an H make a two-component notation for the psi. And you can combine these into a single two-component equation. I think I picked this up from Nambu. And it turns out that you don't make a mistake if you do it this way. And this is a, the H star is here because I'm going to introduce a gauge field, and that when I have a derivative, I'm going to make that into a covariant derivative. Before the covariant, before I introduce a vector potential, the H0 and the H0 star are the same thing. When I introduce a vector potential, one of them will have a plus IA and the other a minus IA. In any case, all these operators are Hermitian, and this is a Hermitian operator. So it has real eigenvalues. And when you will diagonalize it, you will get eigenfunctions of the type which are the spatial generalizations of the Bogoliubov equations. And I'll tell you why I do all of this. That's really too much detail. We don't have time. How much do I want to go into detail? Questions is how much detail, how much detail. Maybe I can get by. I think I can make things reasonable. Okay, so the important thing is that you have these two things, and they're mixed because of this mixing of the particles and holes in here. So you're forced to, when you quantize, to introduce the U's and the V's, one of which appears in the expansion of that in terms of a basis set, and the other in terms of that in the basis set to get the eigenvalue. So the U's and the V's are the basis set which will diagonalize the whole thing. That's what you do. And the delta is borrowed from here. And the delta then is determined so consistently there. Now, the important thing I want to stress is that I want to describe a superflow. And that's the real punchline of this whole business for the moment, before I get into the gauge question. I don't know if I'll get into the gauge question today. Describe a flow. I say that a flow described by a complex value of delta, and when you put this in and take the Fourier component of these equations, which are diagonalizing this two-component equation, these equations become dk uk. And dk dk. These are particles and holes, and that's why you have a difference in sign. But the main point now Hermitian conjugate, right? And this had to be a Hermitian operator. And that's why you have a delta star here. So if there's an e to the iq dot r, there's an e to the minus 2 iq dot r there. So that's uk, uk. That's what comes down. So you see the solutions are the uk is essentially what it would be if there were no flow, times e to the iq dot r. And here's the punchline. And vk is essentially what it would be times the phase e to the minus iq dot r. So the uk's and vk's are multiplied by these flow phase factors. And correspondingly, it corresponds to that the BKs of BCS on the flow go into AK plus Q up A minus K plus Q down. All of this I wrote down just to show you that it doesn't emerge from magic. That what happens is that but you begin with a BCS wave function at rest. Here's my BCS sphere, which is built up. There's a fixed frame of reference. It's quite subtle. And unfortunately, I don't think it well explained anywhere, except in my notes. There's this interior part of the BCS sphere, which is unaffected by the binding. It's like the normal family sphere. And then outside here, you have this perturbed part corresponding to the UK-VK as a condensate. UK, VK, and not equal to zero is here. In this region, UK, VK is not equal to zero. This region is stuck. It is just obtained variationally by building up the wave function in the usual family way, where the UK VK is zero. That fixes the frame. Then around me, I have the supercut, which is formed by these guys, by these pairs, which are bound in there. That's where the game is played. And so when I have a supercurrent flowing, it's the displacement of the annulus with respect to the fixed frame. That's this. It's the Fourier transform of the BKs are carrying momentum. The pairs are no longer AKA minus K of zero momentum, but each S state, which is contributing to the condensate in there, is moving. But my trunk ain't. My trunk is the middle. And it's moving with respect to my trunk. And that is the supercurrent. The supercurrent is a flow of the bound BCS pairs encoded in the BCS wave function through the expectation value of the BK, but shifted to have a total momentum Q. And that is superflow. Now, once you have that solution, and that's clearly a solution, and you put that into these equations and you find it's a solution. So, from there I can calculate the EKs. I can calculate the eigenvalues. Okay. Now that I have the solution. The result is quite beautiful. And it gives you the whole secret of the Landau-Ginzburg system. So these are the eigenvalues. And so what you find for small enough Q is that the eigenvalues of the flowing super pairs, that the gap, that the EKs, which are the CK squared plus delta squared, become the unperturbed energy minus K dot Q over N when you work it out. So this means that as you boost up Q, that the gap, when you boost up the Q to the point that K dot Q becomes comparable with delta in here, on the average, that you're going to lose the gap. So this means that for a sufficiently high superfluid velocity, Q over M, K is of the order of KF, but for a sufficiently high superfluid velocity, you're going to lose the gap. And therefore, when you try to force through current through the superconductor, It will stop being a superconductor if the current gets too high, because you lose the gap. Now this has to be moderated, and there's a section that was added in Tinkham's book sometime in the 1990s, which I didn't read in detail, in which they pushed this analysis further, and they discovered that it's possible, nevertheless, to recover some features of superconductivity, even though it becomes gapless. So some of the thermodynamics of the superconductivity remains, but it's gapless as it flows, which is a peculiar thing. He was very proud of that thing, and I remember when it came out. That's totally gapless. But this is the important thing. Now, this being so, what happens is that when you have gradients in the system, that the energy goes up and the superconductivity tends to go away. So this promotes the Landau-Ginzburg equation. The Landau-Ginzburg equation for delta bar, a complex field. One part of it, and we know already, if I'm near TC, then there's going to be a term minus mu squared in the action, minus mu squared delta squared plus lambda delta squared squared. But that's because I explained to you what's the perfect analogy of the spin system. So everything that happens to spin for the effective field, where we got an effective action, which was minus m squared plus m4, that we have to expect. But mind you, Landau did this in 1937. However, there's more to it. Because the superconductivity is going to go away, if the delta has a flow in it, has a gradient in it, which are too high. So there's going to be an action which is going to go in the same sense as this term, and there's going to be a term proportional to the gradient of delta squared, which is reflecting the movement, how the movement of the superfluid, which contains the gradient of the delta squared, is going to go away. And I wrote the action, it has to be even in the cube to work out the net result of the independent flow. So the origin of this term, is here. This term tends to be temperature independent, the coefficient of this term tends to be temperature independent, and the coefficient of this term is like for the magnet, it's T minus TC. So that's the origin of the famous Ginzburg-Landau equation, subject to one modification, namely, if an electromagnetic field is present, then that goes to I down minus 2E. And that's to make everything have gauge invariance of the second kind, because we want to keep the symmetry of the equation. We have del being a complex field. We want to allow a symmetry that del can be changed by a phase which depends on R. Yes, so and we want to allow the symmetry. So this is a very important lesson. And then we'll do the Josephson effect and contact flux next time. Can't do it all. We have del as a complex field, and we can make a gauge transformation. Now, if we made a gauge transformation on this form, then we wouldn't have an invariance, because that would introduce gradient chi. And the action would be a non-invariant by terms in gradient chi. The way you compensate for that is that the way that you can see the chi doesn't have any influence here. But it has influence there. And the way you compensate for it is that you invent remember here that the del is bilinear in the fermionic operators. And so that's why I put a 2 here. You need a 2 EA, because this corresponds to psi going to psi. Corresponding psi. Del is psi psi, so del is 2i psi. And so the way you introduce the A field to make this whole thing covariant chi transformations, del, not del, A, I think plus. I think it's okay. Well, it's either plus or minus, whichever one you need to get. And so that's called gauge invariance of the second chi. So you introduce an A field to enlarge the symmetry from the symmetry against phase transformations. These are the phase transformations in the xy plane of the effective magnet. You now make this space dependent, these rotations, at the expense of introducing an electromagnetic field. So the electromagnetic field is already in there in order to ensure the symmetry, but then you have to write an action for the electromagnetic field. So then you have to add the electromagnetic field. What can you deem you in? And that's why you can tell you this. So you need that term. And therefore, you've invented in this Ginzburg-Landau thing a complete space description, a phenomenological description, which is not all that phenomenological. based on very tight reasoning for Dinier to TC. It's based on very tight reasoning of introducing the gradient through the exercise which I wrote, how you describe a flow. And then you make a gauge invariant of the second kind, and you get the whole story.
So what would be gauge invariant of the first kind? What would be gauge invariant of the first kind?
Before, when chi does not depend on R.
Okay.
So you could not get by with gauge invariance of the first kind when you have flow. Mm-hmm. You have to introduce an electromagnetic field. Therefore, I'm showing that when you have flow, that you have to have a counter-magnetic field, because you have to have an A to keep the gauge, invariance. It's very cute, huh? So automatically, when you have the supercurrent, the magnetic field is delivered to you in this, in the same way as London said it should be. I reflected last night on the amount of genius that went into these things between 1930 and 1960, absolutely incredible. First London, and then Landau, and then BCS, and then Volkin-Dubov, Anderson, Nambu. Absolutely incredible story. To have understood all of this without the aid of field theory, without the formal aid of field theory as we know it, because with their bare hands. So next time, we'll complete it in a few minutes. I'll show you that the role of the A is to give you the London quantized flux, and I'll give you the Josephson effect. My way to do it. I have a cute way to get the Josephson effect. Will you still be here next week? No, you're gone. But that took you pretty far.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I missed the punchline.
Well, the punchline then is that if you just write down the whole system, and then you find it applicable to describe elementary particle physics. That's the most amazing thing of all. And Raphael Stork and asked me the other day, why did we do this in the 1960s when it was all written by that one? Well, I feel shame. We simply didn't know.